My fellow Americans, renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply.
There's no friendlies over there. Go ahead and let them have it.
Keep walking behind the tanks and stepping in the new tank tracks. They're mining the old track where we found the 105 mine.
What do you see up there?
The war between the United States and Vietnam took the lives of more than 58,000 American soldiers. Millions of Vietnamese men, women, and children.
Young men, Vietnamese and American, are falling like trees to lie forever with their faces in the mud. Let's be angry, truly angry. Let's be horrified. Let's be afraid.
It left one country physically devastated, and the other socially splintered.
My brother-in-law is over there, and with my heart, whole heart, I'm hoping it comes to an end because we want him home. We miss him, we love him very much. The whole family wishes he was back with us so this would be settled.
One, two, three, what are we fighting for?
Although my countrymen had been in Southeast Asia since World War II, the quiet Americans described by Graham Greene's 1955 novel, open warfare only began 50 years ago.
The attacks were deliberate.
President Lyndon Johnson told the world it started on the night of August 4th, 1964.
The attacks were unprovoked.
In a place called the Gulf of Tonkin.
The attacks have been answered.
You may remember that at the time the American government announced that two United States destroyers, the Maddox and the Tanner Joy, had been attacked.
The Gulf of Tonkin incident was the starting gun in America's involvement in Vietnam.
The Americans. Congress, inflamed by that attack, passed the now famous Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which in effect gave President Johnson the power to conduct the war as he saw fit without reference to Congress.
In 1960, the United States had fewer than 1,000 men in Vietnam, none of them engaged in combat. 10 months after Tonkin, there were 75,000 troops. By 1968, their number would grow to more than 500,000. Even more important, you could argue the Gulf of Tonkin and its aftermath created the template for presidential war making in Iraq and Afghanistan, and may yet draw us into Syria. But the incident on August 4th, the unprovoked attack that launched the Vietnam War, may never have taken place. Evidence emerged slowly over the decades, a piece at a time. Archives released by the Pentagon, recordings of White House phone conversations between President Johnson and his aides, classified congressional testimony, top secret interviews by the National Security Agency, whose very existence wasn't acknowledged until a few years ago. President Johnson was given sweeping powers after the Gulf of Tonkin and used them to destroy his presidency. But before we can ask whether history will repeat itself, we need to know what actually happened. I'm D.D. Guttenplan. Stay with me over the next hour on the BBC World Service as I examine the evidence and ask, did Lyndon Johnson take his country to war on a lie? I just turned 7 years old that summer and was probably asleep when the president came on the TV to report he was ordering airstrikes against a country thousands of miles away. Soon, though, the war felt very close. Not just because it was on the news every night. There was a family who lived across the street from us in Philadelphia, the Fogelsangers. Their sons babysat me and my little brother and sister. All three boys went to Vietnam. Our next-door neighbor, Captain Francis Finnegan, served three tours in Vietnam. When President Johnson said that two American destroyers had been attacked, we believed him. To understand what happened on the 4th, we have to first go back 2 days earlier.
Dad was in the air on August 2nd.
Jim Stockdale's father, Squadron Commander James Bond Stockdale, was the senior pilot aboard the USS Ticonderoga, an aircraft carrier stationed in the Gulf of Tonkin, an arm of the South China Sea off the coast of North Vietnam.
He was leading a flight group in a standard, what they call combat air patrol, when his radio broke through and told him to change to strike channel.
What does that mean?
It means that this is not a drill. You're seriously being called for something that is important.
The Ticonderoga's job was to provide air support for the USS Maddox, an American destroyer on a top-secret mission known as a DeSoto patrol.
The DeSoto patrols were U.S. Navy platforms that were conducting electronic eavesdropping along installations of the North Vietnamese coast. And this was commonly referred to as SIGINT, or Signals Intelligence.
Pat Patterson is a professor at the National Defense University in Washington, D.C.
SIGINT was the ability to collect signatures, electronic signatures of the radars or the fire control systems that the North Vietnamese were using. It also allowed them to collect communications, verbal communications that were being relayed through from higher command to local regional commands and stuff like that. On August 2nd, the Maddox had received communications intercepts that indicated that the North Vietnamese vessels were getting underway, possibly with the intent of attacking the U.S. Navy vessels, the Maddox. The senior officer afloat was a Captain John J. Herrick. He ordered the ship's captain to turn the vessel out to sea, hoping to avoid a confrontation. But later on that afternoon, the ship noticed and detected three North Vietnamese patrol boats approaching her position from the west. So what followed next was a short but fierce battle between the three North Vietnamese patrol boats and the U.S. Navy destroyer.
Secretary McNamara, line O.
I wonder if you don't think it would be wise to you and Russ to get Mac, the Speaker and Mansfield to call a group of 15, 20 people together from the Armed Services and Foreign Relations, tell them what happened. A good many of them are saying to me.
Right. I've been thinking about this myself, and I thought that
they're going to start an investigation if you don't.
The Maddox opened fire at about 3 in the afternoon local time on Sunday the 2nd. Shortly after 10 the next morning in Washington, Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara phones the president. Although Richard Nixon's White House tapes are better known thanks to Watergate, his predecessor, Lyndon Johnson, also recorded 800 hours of conversations. These tapes, which Johnson ordered should be kept sealed for 50 years after his death, began to emerge in the 1990s and take us right inside the Oval Office.
You say they fired at us. We responded immediately, and we took out one of their boats and put the other two running, and we're putting our boats right there, and we're not
our
running on any.
Are to destroy.
That's right.
Right, we're going to go. And I think I should also, or we should also at that time, Mr. President, explain this Op Plan 34A, these covert operations. There's no question but what that had bearing on it. And Friday night, as you probably know, we had four TP boats from Vietnam, manned by Vietnamese or other nationals, attacked two islands. And we expended 1,000 rounds of ammunition, one kind of.
The Op Plan 34A covert operations that McNamara says had some bearing on what the president would describe as an unprovoked attack were combat raids against North Vietnam.
Following 24 hours after that with this destroyer in that same area undoubtedly led them to connect the two events.
Well, say that to Dirksen. And you notice Dirksen says this morning that
Operations Plan 34 Alpha, or Op Plan 34 Alpha as it's more commonly referred, were top secret missions run by the South Vietnamese Navy in the Gulf of Tonkin. And they were supported by the U.S. Department of Defense, and even with some support from the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. These were initially, in the early stages, these were commando raids against North Vietnamese installations up along the North Vietnamese coast.
So how did America get involved in Vietnam? And why did such a small, distant country matter so much to President Johnson? It all began after World War II, when France tried to hold on to its colony, Indochina.
I think fundamentally there was a conflict in Vietnam because you had a kind of collision of nationalisms.
Historian Frederick Logoval is the author of The Origins of the Vietnam War.
In the first instance, between the Viet Minh, led by Ho Chi Minh, the revolutionary organization in Vietnam, and colonial France on the other side.
Francis Fitzgerald's book Fire in the Lake, The Vietnamese and the Americans in Vietnam, won the Pulitzer Prize for History in 1972.
I think they really were looking for, first of all, trade routes into China, also to sort of match British colonialism in India.
Vietnam was a kind of, or Indochina was a kind of consolation prize for the French in the scramble for imperial spoils.
I think that's right.
Those two nationalisms, those two sides waged a war that lasted about 8 years. The United States supported France in that effort. And then once the French were defeated, the United States basically made a commitment to try to succeed where the French had failed, which was to thwart this revolutionary movement under Ho Chi Minh, to support a non-communist regime in the southern part of Vietnam, while at the same time, Ho and his colleagues were determined still to prevail, now against this new foe.
I have another secret intelligence report here. This one tells what another communist officer in the Far East told his men several months before the invasion of Korea. And here's what he said. In order to successfully undertake the long-awaited world revolution, we must first unify Asia, Java, Indochina.
Franklin Roosevelt refused to let U.S. ships carry French troops back to Indochina, which had been occupied by the Japanese. So when Ho Chi Minh entered Hanoi in the summer of 1945, he hoped for American support. Indeed, Ho's Vietnamese Declaration of Independence, quoting the American Declaration, begins, "All men are created equal." But by then, Harry Truman was president, and as the Cold War turned hot in Korea, nationalism soon took a back seat to the fight against communism. President Truman.
The United States is the only obstacle on our road for the liberation of all the countries in Southeast Asia. In other words, we must unify the people of Asia and crush the United States. Again, liberation in commie language means conquest.
The word Dien Bien Phu is no longer just a funny sounding name to be dismissed from the breakfast conversation because we don't know where it is nor what it means.
After Ho's troops defeated the French at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower worried that if Vietnam fell...
You have a row of dominoes set up, and you knock over the first one, and what will happen to the last one is certainly that it'll go over very quickly.
Vietnam is partitioned along the 17th parallel. Elections to unify the country are supposed to be held in 1956, but the Americans are certain that Ho will win. They get Ngo Dinh Diem, who they've installed as ruler in the south, to cancel them. Though Diem's dictatorial methods are increasingly unpopular, John Kennedy is determined not to be the president who loses Vietnam. Greater effort is made by the government. Kennedy had been deeply critical of the South Vietnamese government.
In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it. We can help them, we can give them equipment, we can send our men out there.
Yet he had steadily increased the American presence from a few hundred advisors to nearly 17,000 troops.
News has just come in that President Kennedy has been shot. There's no news yet of his condition. It happened as the president was riding with his wife in an open car through the streets of Dallas, Texas.
In the 9 months after John F. Kennedy's assassination, Lyndon Johnson rallied the country to support his great society. Johnson promised an end to poverty and racial injustice. On July 2nd, with Martin Luther King standing by his side, he signed the Civil Rights Act, ending racial segregation. But the president also inherited Vietnam.
Their target is not merely South Vietnam. It is Asia. Their objective is not the fulfillment of Vietnamese nationalism. It is to erode and to discredit America's ability to help prevent Chinese domination over all of Asia.
But Cold War strategy was only part of the picture.
I don't think that one can say anymore that it was about the Cold War, that it was about preserving American credibility, that it was about maintaining a commitment to the South Vietnamese government.
Frederick Loegeval.
I think that one also now has to fold into that explanation, which is partially correct, the importance of domestic political imperatives, that I think up until his assassination, John F. Kennedy in 63, and then Lyndon Johnson thereafter in 1964, felt that in order to survive politically ultimately at home and to prosper in terms of their domestic political position, they needed to affirm this commitment to the South Vietnamese government.
So it was a mix of global politics and domestic politics?
It was a mix of the two. I think that by the time we get to 1964, those domestic political imperatives are actually supreme.
Politics is never off Lyndon Johnson's mind, as you can hear in this August 3rd conversation with Robert McNamara, recorded at the White House.
The people that are calling me up, I just talked to a New York banker, I just talked to a fellow in Texas, they all feel that the Navy responded wonderfully, and that's good, but they want to be damn sure I don't pull them out and run, and they want to be damn sure that we're firm. That's what all the country wants, because Goldwater's raising so much hell about how he's going to blow them off the moon, and they say that we oughtn't to do anything that the national interest doesn't require, but we sure ought to always leave the impression that if you shoot at us, you're going to get hit. Well, I think
1964 is an election year. Just 2 weeks earlier, accepting the Republican nomination in San Francisco, Johnson's opponent Barry Goldwater made Vietnam a campaign issue.
We are at war in Vietnam. And yet the president, who is the commander-in-chief of our forces, refuses to say, mind you, whether or not the objective over there is victory.
And his secretary... This was my very first day, August 4th, by coincidence. When I came in the morning, McNaughton was already down the hall conferring with Secretary McNamara about something I was soon to learn.
On August 4th, 1964, 2 days after the attack on the Maddox, Daniel Ellsberg, who'd gone from Harvard to the Marine Corps to become a high-flying military analyst, started a new job at the Pentagon.
I'd been very involved at a staff level, high staff level, in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And as a result, I got a study set up on nuclear crises. I'd spent most of the year of 64 in the Pentagon doing that when I was offered to be a full-time employee as a special assistant to the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, then held by John T. McNaughton, a former Harvard law professor.
At 9:23 that morning, reports start to come into Washington of the possibility of another attack in the Gulf of Tonkin. Here, General Earl Wheeler, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, asks Keith McCutcheon at the headquarters of the Pacific Command what he's heard. Their conversation was recorded by the Defense Department's National Military Command Center.
This is Command Center. We have General Wheeler for General McCutcheon.
Yes? It's General Wheeler.
Yes, sir.
Have you seen the traffic having to do with a postulated attack on the DeSoto patrol?
On who?
On the DeSoto patrol.
You mean over and above what took place in the last couple of days?
That's right. This is some traffic that's just been coming in.
No, sir.
Having to do with an attack, possible attack. This has been picked up and passed around, and I just wondered if you were aware of it.
No, sir, I'm not, but I'll get right on it.
Hello. Secretary McNamara is calling you again, sir. Uh-oh.
20 minutes later, before the White House even receives the first report of an attack, Johnson and McNamara are already planning their response.
What I was thinking about when I was eating breakfast, but I couldn't talk it, I was thinking that looks to me like the weakness of our position is that we respond only to an action, and we don't have any of our own, but when they move on us and they shoot at us, I think we not only ought to shoot at them, but almost simultaneously pull one of these things that you've been doing, right, on one of their bridges or something.
Exactly. I quite agree with you, Mr. President. I'm not sure that the response ought to be as Admiral Sharp suggests.
Well, I'm not either. I don't know, unless I knew what base it was and what was confirmed. But I wish we could have something that we've already picked out and just hit about three of them damn quick right after.
We will have that, and I talked to Mac Bundy a moment ago and told him that I thought that was the most important subject we should consider today, and be prepared to recommend to you a response, a retaliation move against North Vietnam in the event this attack takes place within the next 6 to 9 hours.
When the Johnson tapes were released, or at least this particular tape was released, I think it was highly revealing because it confirmed what many of us had believed prior to that release.
Historian Frederick Logoval.
That the administration is seeking some kind of opportunity here, and it is moving more quickly on the 4th of August than would seem reasonable based on what we knew beforehand. So I took this conversation as being really important, and that Johnson is giving this directive at this point before he actually knows what's happened. The conclusion I draw from that is that they were ready to go.
In the Pentagon, word comes in from the Pacific.
I was sitting just at a desk in the foyer, basically, of his suite of offices when a messenger came running in with a flash message.
Daniel Ellsberg.
It was the only time I remember that somebody came in running, because the message was a flash message which is supposed to be delivered within 10 minutes. In this case, it was that our destroyer, the Maddox in the Tonkin Gulf, was again under torpedo attack, as it had reported 2 days earlier on August 2nd. These messages were also, of course, being sent to McNamara's office.
At 11.06 a.m. D.C. time, Robert McNamara phones the president.
We just had word by telephone from Admiral Sharp that the destroyer is under torpedo attack. I think I might get Dean Rusk and Mac Bundy, have them come over here, and we'll go over these retaliatory actions, and then we ought to...
I sure think you'll agree with that, yeah.
And I've got a category here. I'll call it to them.
Now, where are these torpedoes coming from?
Well, we don't know. Presumably from these unidentified craft that I mentioned to you a moment ago.
What are these planes that are doing around while they're being attacked?
Well, presumably the planes are attacking the ships. We don't have any word from Sharp on that.
Okay. Now, you get them over there, and then you come over here as soon as you can.
I'll do that, yeah.
One of those planes flying above the Maddox was piloted by James Stockdale. In the Gulf of Tonkin, it was a moonless night.
On the night of August 4th, and it was a, as they say, a dark and stormy night, unusual on the Gulf. There were thunderstorms, thunderheads, lightning. At about 7 or 8 in the evening, someone poked his head in the ready room and said to Dad, who was, again, the commanding officer of the squadron, "Are they ready?" And Dad didn't know what he meant, but he looked at the board and saw that he had two junior officers sitting in planes adjacent the catapults on the aircraft carrier. Dad heard the planes start to start up, and he grabbed his flight gear and ran up, realizing that a lieutenant junior grade was in a plane, and climbed up the side of the airplane and said, "Get out, I'm getting in." This was more than vanity. He realized that he had seen something similar to what might be going on in the dark, 2 days before in broad daylight.
He wanted to go up because he felt he would know what to look for.
Yes.
Because of his experience on the second.
Right, and he was the most experienced pilot on the ship.
I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan, and you're listening to War, Lies, and Audio Tape. The story of the controversial Gulf of Tonkin incident, which marked the start of America's war in Vietnam 50 years ago this month, continues on the BBC World Service in a moment.
Weekends on the BBC World Service.
The BBC's Razia Iqbal has been talking to some of the world's most influential architects and designers.
I think it's our task as architects to be visionary.
Next is Francine Huben from the Netherlands.
Our profession should always be connected to the society, and the society is changing.
She talks about her design aspirations.
What I want to do is touch senses with architecture. It's about space, it's about acoustics, it's about shadows, it's about framing views.
And answers questions from an audience.
Is there any major advantage or disadvantage as a female architect?
I think as a woman, or even if you want to also be a mother, you have to really be multitasking. You need family around you that is supportive. It's hard, so you really need a passion.
Dream Builders with Francine Huben. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
On August 4th, 1964, President Lyndon Johnson told the world about an unprovoked attack on American ships in the Gulf of Tonkin. This would be the starting gun for America's war in Vietnam. Yet the incident on August 4th, the unprovoked attack that launched the Vietnam War, may never have taken place. I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan. When War, Lies, and Audio Tape continues on the BBC World Service in a few minutes, I'll be asking, did President Johnson take his country to war on a lie?
BBC News with Eileen McHugh. Several trucks in a Russian aid convoy that travelled without permission to rebel-held eastern Ukraine on Friday have returned to Russia. More than 200 trucks drove to Luhansk on Friday after Russia said it was tired of waiting for clearance from the Ukrainian government. Moscow says the convoy was strictly humanitarian, but Western nations called it a pretext for further military intervention. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel is due shortly to hold talks in Kiev with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. Senior officials in Hamas say the militant group has signed a pledge to back any Palestinian application to join the International Criminal Court. The move completes the consensus among Palestinian factions that President Mahmoud Abbas says he needs before any such application. Correspondents say Mr. Abbas knows that if he makes the application, he risks infuriating both the United States, which is not a member of the court, and Israel, which could find itself exposed to war crimes investigations. The European Space Agency says the latest two satellites for Europe's alternative to the American GPS satellite navigation system have not gone into the correct orbit. The agency said the fifth and sixth satellites launched from French Guiana on Friday were under control and it was examining the implications of the anomaly. Afghanistan's long-running and disputed presidential election moves into a final stage this weekend as a recount and audit of votes gets underway. For every ballot box, decisions will be made over which votes will be discarded because of fraud. The process could take months. And police in Britain have charged two lorry drivers from Northern Ireland over the discovery of 35 Sikhs from Afghanistan smuggled into the port of Tilbury near London in a shipping container a week ago. One of the migrants, a 40-year-old man, was found dead and others were treated in hospital. BBC News.
I'm Dee Dee Guttenplan and you're listening to War, Lies and Audiotape on the BBC World Service, the story of the controversial Gulf of Tonkin incident, the starting gun for America's war in Vietnam that began 50 years ago this month. At 11:18 a.m. Washington time on August 4, 1964, American military officials received reports that the USS Maddox, an American destroyer in the Gulf of Tonkin, was under attack.
Hello, Dave.
Yes, Ollie.
I guess you know they've started shooting at them.
Yep.
Both ways. One of them has said they have dodged five torpedoes.
There was another courier running in with another one confirming it. Now several torpedoes are in the water. We're taking evasive action.
Daniel Ellsberg.
Strangely, though, an attack tended to be a matter of minutes. This went on for over an hour.
Well, apparently been at least nine torpedoes in the water, all missed, and apparently two of the boats have been sunk, as far as we can tell.
These numbers of torpedoes being reported by the two destroyers there kept adding up. Eventually, it was between 20 and 30, which was a little surprising, especially to the people on the ship, because North Vietnam was supposed to have only about 24 torpedoes in their entire fleet.
Does McNaughton come in to talk to you during any of this? Do you talk to anyone about all this?
No. I was basically, as I say, my boss was down there, and I was with the military aides, a couple of them, and secretaries back in his office. And we were all very excited by this. I was a strong Cold Warrior, as I say, at that time. And my first reaction was, of course, we must strike back. Then, at 1:30, a very startlingly different message comes in. Again, flash. And this is from Commodore Herrick, saying, in effect, hold everything.
John J. Herrick was in command of the Maddox.
He says, a study of the reports indicates that most of the reports seem to have been in error. An overeager sonar man and freak weather effects and electronic effects here have resulted in false reports. He was still sure there had been an attack based on the initial torpedo, but he said all subsequent reports of torpedoes are mistaken. And a second message very shortly after, he said, I recommend holding off any further action until daylight reconnaissance. So I assume they would want to hold it off, and certainly that seemed appropriate to me. But the word again coming back in the course of the afternoon, no, it's not off. We're still going ahead, awaiting, as I took it, further confirmation, but we're making all the preparations for it.
3 hours later, they're still not sure there was actually an attack. 4:40 p.m.
There is still
amount of doubt.
As to whether he actually had one or not?
Just exactly what went on. So he said, well, what do you think? And I said, I had told Moore about half an hour before that we had to get some definite information from these characters out there. And he's gone out for it, and I told him I thought we'd have it within 2 hours.
One report said that no question of what they were illuminated and had guns fired at them.
Yep, and we've got another one here. Certain that original ambush was bona fide. Details of action following present a confusing picture. Have interviewed witnesses who made positive visual signs. Have you seen that one?
No.
Of cockpit lights or similar passing near Maddox. It looks fairly certain.
Meanwhile, the news has leaked to the wire services.
Yes, Bob, Mr. President, the story is broken on the AP and the UP.
Yeah, I see it.
And we've tried to track it down. Jim Greenfield talked to the AP, I understand, and was told it came from a source close to the Pentagon who was alleged to be a chairman of a congressional committee. I don't know what the source is, but anyhow, it's broken. And it seems to me State and we and George Reedy ought to agree now on a statement that could be made by one of the departments, I presume the Pentagon. But before doing that, I wanted to ask your permission to do so. The statement that we would make, I would propose, would simply say that during the night hours, the two destroyers were attacked by patrol boats. The attack was driven off. No casualties or damage to the destroyers. We believe several of the patrol boats were sunk. Details won't be available until daylight.
That's okay.
All right, I'll take care of it.
I just go and put that out.
All right, I'll take care of it.
My sense is that press leak nicely served the administration's purposes, ultimately.
Frederick Logevall.
It again sent out to a great many Americans and to others the sense that we have the North Vietnamese once again being aggressive. They must be looking here to engage. They must be looking to step things up. That leak is going to serve the administration's purposes with Congress, and also in terms of broader public opinion, and finally international audiences.
The fact that the news is now out puts more pressure on the president to act.
Well, the president was planning an attack within hours now and wanted to announce it to the public, and I got involved in this, in more or less prime time or before people had been asleep, preferably at about 8 o'clock our time, but the carrier simply wasn't in position by that time yet, and they had to keep holding him off. He was very anxious to do it before midnight because people would be asleep, and he didn't want them to wake up in the morning and learn that we were at war, had conducted major attacks on North Vietnam for the first time, without their having even been warned that there was a problem.
At 6 that evening, President Johnson takes a call from Olin Johnston, Democratic senator from South Carolina.
The newspapers called me today and wanted to know if I was going to vote for you. I said, yes, I'm for keeping us out of war. And I'm voting for Lyndon Johnson.
Well, I don't know whether I can do that. I'm going to do my best, Olin.
But the reason I said that, you're going to find in my state and in the South, these mothers and people are afraid of war.
They sure are.
And we got to stress that point down my way in order to get votes.
I sure am, my friend.
Good.
Okay.
Good.
Bye.
The balance of voices here is not what we often believe it to have been. I think there is concern in Congress and in the press, and also, by the way, among allied leaders in governments around the world, A, that the revolution can ultimately be defeated, and B, I think a growing skepticism that the outcome really is all that important to U.S. national security.
I just wanted to see you whenever you were all alone. Just merely to tell you I loved you, that's all.
Will I be over there? The Russell's still there?
No, they left at 3.
At 8:35 p.m., Johnson's wife, Lady Bird, phones. Johnson still hasn't announced the retaliatory strike. Here, he tells her he wants to speak to his Republican opponent, Barry Goldwater, first.
I'm trying to get Senator Goldwater, and I'll come over just as soon as I get through.
Honey,
yeah?
Bring anybody who's a bachelor or who wants to eat or who would otherwise be doing without supper until real late with you, will you?
Okay.
Bye.
At 10:06, Johnson finally reaches Goldwater.
Barry.
I'm going to make a statement in a little bit, and I wanted to talk to you before I did.
All right.
I don't know just what time it'll be, but it'll probably be when we're sure that their radar screen has picked up our plane. As President Commander-in-Chief, it's my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against U.S. ships on the high seas and the Gulf of Tonkin have today required
me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply. The initial attack on the destroyer Maddox on August 2nd was repeated today by a number of hostile vessels attacking two U.S. destroyers with torpedoes. The destroyers and supporting aircraft acted at once.
President Johnson just makes his midnight deadline, interrupting all three U.S. television networks at 11:36 p.m.
We still seek no wider war.
The president, proclaimed the New York Times, went to the American people last night with the somber facts. The Los Angeles Times agreed that the communists, by their attack on American vessels in international waters, have themselves escalated the hostilities. In a speech at Syracuse University the following day, Johnson repeats his accusation.
The attacks were deliberate. The attacks were unprovoked. The attacks have been answered.
Both the president and McNamara assured the public, especially McNamara in detail, that the attack had been unequivocal, that it had been in international waters, and that it was unprovoked. And fourth, he described our policy as being a limited, appropriate attack in response, and quote, "we seek no wider war." Listening to those statements, I already knew that all four of those statements were false.
Daniel Ellsberg.
The attack was anything but unequivocal. The many cables from Herrick actually put it into grave question. International waters, yes, at the time of the alleged attack, but earlier they had been within the waters, the 12-mile limit that North Vietnam actually claimed, and they were steaming out of those waters when they felt that they were under attack. So obviously there had been provocation, whether there was an attack or not. And fourth, I came to be involved in planning that involved a great many people, hundreds, preparing for a wider war shortly after the election in November. So every aspect of that I knew was false. I didn't yet know that evening that there had been no attack at all. That took another day or two for other evidence to make pretty clear.
From 1965 to 67, Daniel Ellsberg worked at the U.S. Embassy in Saigon. In 1971, convinced of the war's futility, he leaked the secret history of the Vietnam War that became known as the Pentagon Papers.
Mom and Dad had invited a couple of old dear friends to come over, and Dad proceeded to tell the story of what had actually happened on the night of August 4th.
So you were there when he told this story?
Yes.
One person who did know there'd been no attack that August 4th was James Stockdale. On a brief visit home about a month later, September 7th, 1964, the Navy pilot gathered his family and friends.
Of course, he did the run-up to the entire episode, and what he wanted the friends and Mom to know was that nothing had happened that night. There had been no boats out there, that he had sent a flash message up through channels indicating that there was nothing out there that night but Black Sea and American firepower. There were no North Vietnamese vessels, and there had been no attack.
That's the night of August 4th.
Correct.
And why did your father feel he needed to tell you this in September?
Immediately after the engagement or non-engagement of the pilots in the air observing and flying and strafing the coordinates given to them by the radio men aboard the destroyers, word backfed through the ship that everything that had happened that night was highly confidential and no one was to talk about it. The walls of secrecy came down very, very quickly, and he wanted someone in the family to know what had actually happened because, of course, he was going to be returning to a war theater, and in case anything happened to him, he wanted to be on the record, at least with his loved ones.
James Stockdale was shot down over Vietnam in September 1965. Held in captivity for nearly 8 years, he was repeatedly beaten and tortured. In 1992, he ran for vice president with Ross Perot. He died in 2005.
Captain Herrick, as well as a couple of other officials, investigated this further. They realized what they were seeing was a number of radar repeaters and radar contacts that were actually just bouncing off of the low clouds and the high seas.
Pat Patterson.
On my own vessel, we saw this a number of times and even went to our battle stations because during the war in Iraq, for example, we thought these were counterattacks by Iraqi vessels. And all it turned out to be were strange atmospheric phenomena that were affecting the radar signatures and the radar reports.
Bearing in mind that absence of evidence is not necessarily evidence of absence, when should it have become clear that there was no attack?
It did become reasonably clear in the upper levels of the United States government as soon as there had been time to take a slow, careful look at the intercepted North Vietnamese radio traffic.
Historian Edwin Moise is the author of Tonkin Gulf and the Escalation of the Vietnam War.
We were listening in on what the North Vietnamese Navy was saying over the radio, and it was pretty clear from what we were hearing over the radio, they were not fighting a battle that night.
You know, we reported the living bejesus out of that, and then a couple days later there was a second attack, and it was another flap.
Delmar Lang was an Air Force lieutenant colonel who wrote the NSA's top secret after-action report on the Gulf of Tonkin. As he recounts in this 1988 oral history, also classified as top secret, in August 1964, he was an intelligence officer in Saigon, analyzing signals intelligence from the DeSoto patrols.
In the initial go-around, we did put out some messages that cautioned against precipitate action because, you know, the evidence was suggestive, but it wasn't firm. And I had, me and my guys had, some reservations at the time about whether that attack had really occurred.
Okay.
President Johnson chose to retaliate with airstrikes, and Congress gave him the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which said, hey man, run. And away we went.
Mm-hmm.
In what turned out, of course, to be probably the biggest tragedy of our country ever got involved in.
Yeah.
Needlessly involved in.
Yeah.
We came across the photos, the night photos, they were like x-rays, of the Tonkin Gulf incident.
Leslie Gelb was director of policy planning at the Defense Department. Robert McNamara appointed him director of the Pentagon Papers Project.
The photos, there were about 20 of them, were full of shots being fired back and forth and back and forth, but you couldn't tell who was doing the firing. And when we saw the after-action reports, which were also available, it was quite clear that our commanders didn't know who was doing the firing, let alone being certain that the North Vietnamese were shooting at us.
On August 7th, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution is passed overwhelmingly by Congress. It begins, that the Congress approves and supports the determination of the President as Commander-in-Chief to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. In the House of Representatives, the vote is unanimous. In the Senate, the only dissenters are Ernest Gruening of Alaska, a former editor of The Nation magazine, and Wayne Morse of Oregon. At the very least, Morse knew that what Johnson labeled aggression had actually been provoked, as he told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee 4 years later.
There isn't the slightest question, and history will show we were a provocateur. And that's why on August 5th, 1964, and again August 6th, 1964, I made the two speeches on the history of this matter, tried to warn the Senate that we were a provocateur, because I'd had a call from a high official in the Pentagon building the night before, asking me to call for the logs, asking me to ask what the Maddox was doing. For the Secretary of Defense to say she was on a routine patrol just doesn't square with the facts. She was on a provocateur patrol. Well, of course she was on the high...
But Morse's objections were brushed aside. Frederick Logoval.
The congressional resolution has been basically sitting, ready to go, for several months, and the administration has been debating at least to some extent, when it would be proper to introduce a congressional resolution authorizing the president to use really whatever means he wishes to protect American interests in Southeast Asia.
When is the line crossed from confusion to deception?
Oh, it's a very large question. You know, my sense from reading a good chunk of that evidence, some of which has appeared only in the last few years, is that the line was crossed pretty early. I come back to the point that in some important way, I believe the administration was looking for a pretext to flex American military muscle. And so that early on the 4th, Washington time, I think there is a de facto decision. And perhaps in some discussion that is not taped, but that is in some room or other in the White House, that we are going to do this. We're still going to be restrained. I still, as president, want to be able to go to the voters and say, I seek no wider war. But we had an obligation here to show the South Vietnamese, to show the North Vietnamese, and to show adversaries and allies around the world that we will not be pushed around, and we are going to show what we can do, and we're going to do it here.
It's one thing to launch the retaliatory counterattack, even though that was based upon questionable intelligence and that the facts were still being clarified. That's one thing.
Pat Patterson.
However, it's an entirely different thing to distort the facts to Congress as they investigated the incident over the next couple days, especially as they debated on whether or not they would approve the, what becomes known as the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution.
Within days of the incident, the radical journalist I.F. Stone wrote in his weekly, "Everything is discussed except the possibility that the attack might have been provoked." Other reporters were beginning to ask awkward questions, too. On August 8th, McNamara gave Johnson a cover story developed by McGeorge Bundy, a former Harvard dean who was national security advisor to Presidents Kennedy and Johnson.
I do think that if you have a press conference today, you're going to get questions on the claim that of the North Vietnamese that their strike on the 2nd against the Maddox was retaliation for U.S. participation in the strike of July 30-31 against those islands. And I called Mac this morning and asked him to write a specific question and a specific answer to this. This is a very delicate subject, and he and I agreed on such an answer, and he said he would get it to you.
All right, what's the net of it?
Well, the net of it is that you state categorically that U.S. forces did not participate in, were not associated with any alleged incident of that kind. They weren't even in the area at that point and didn't enter the area until 2 days later.
Is this outgrowth of John's briefing?
Well, I don't know.
So 50 years after the Gulf of Tonkin incident, what have we learned? That presidents lie? We may have to wait decades to find out what George Bush said to Tony Blair about Iraq, or what Barack Obama told David Cameron about Syria. But we do now know almost all of what happened, and didn't, in the Gulf of Tonkin.
The reason we got involved in Vietnam was not that we lied our way into that war, but we believed our way into that war.
After working on the Pentagon Papers, Leslie Gelb became a reporter for the New York Times. He's now President Emeritus of the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations.
This was really the height of the Cold War. We saw this as the confrontation point where the forces of the Soviet Union and China were using the North Vietnamese to face us down, to beat us, and consequently we had to fight and win. So it was a matter of conviction rather than believing the lies of the war.
Why did President Johnson feel it was necessary to carry on with a fabrication or a deception?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but there were times where presidents felt they had to lie in the national interest. He was not an exception. And once you make a big lie like that, it's hard to walk it back without affecting your credibility. So he left it alone.
And what do you think the larger lessons we ought to learn from the Gulf of Tonkin incident and its aftermath are?
Well, this is the kind of thing that should cause the general public to hesitate about just simply accepting what their leaders say in a time of crisis. We ought to greet these things with skepticism, but we tend to let it go too lightly.
Even now, 50 years later, there are still parts of the story locked in government vaults.
Oh, the last piece has not come out yet. Some pieces have not been found, and quite likely will never be found, but might turn up somewhere.
Edwin Moyes.
I would love to get my hands on the record of the meeting where NSA and CIA reported to the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board on this.
So that report, that meeting, is still secret.
I'm going to have a try at it and expect to fail, but I'm waiting until 50 years have passed, which is a few weeks from now.
Still, we know enough to say a few things. One, as Leslie Gelb reminded us, is about the importance of skepticism. Another is about the limits of power and what happens when officials and governments feel compelled to pretend those limits don't exist. Fred Logoval.
What this period in the Vietnam War demonstrates is that U.S. military power, no matter how great it is in relative terms, is ultimately limited. And moreover, I would say that what's key about this is that people knew this at the time. A great many knowledgeable people in the Congress, in the administration, one might even include Lyndon Johnson himself, privately said, I don't know whether we can do this. Johnson said at one point, I think in the spring of 64, I don't think we can win in Vietnam, and I don't think we can get out. That's a takeaway, that you can have all the military power in the world, but if you can't win the thing politically, then you're not going to succeed.
Finally, though, the Gulf of Tonkin reminds us what happens to a military, a government, and a society when people feel they've been taken to war for a lie. In 1971, while the fighting still raged, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee invited a group of Vietnam veterans to testify. One of them was a young naval lieutenant.
But also we found that the Vietnamese, whom we had enthusiastically molded after our own image, were hard put to take up the fight against the threat we were supposedly saving them from.
First elected to the Senate in 1985, John Kerry was the Democratic candidate for president in 2004. He is the current American Secretary of State.
We found that most people didn't even know the difference between communism and democracy. They only wanted to work in rice paddies, without helicopters strafing them, and bombs, with napalm, burning their villages and tearing their country apart.
Of all the questions raised by the Gulf of Tonkin, or by all the wars that have come after, perhaps the hardest, and yet the most important, was posed by the young John Kerry.
Because how do you ask a man to be the last man to die in Vietnam? How do you ask a man to be the last man to die for a mistake?
War, Lies, and Audio Tape was written and presented by me, D.D. Guttenplan. It was a Something Else production. The producer was Peggy Sutton.